Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here at KHOI Community Radio around our kitchen table to talk about a lot of good things to eat, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Yes, they do. And here we are. We are going to talk about things seasonal today, things Christmassy, and we want to thank our listeners for, again, hanging with us for another year. We think of all our loved ones and our maybe not so loved ones, but all the people we know.
The clan, the tribe, the family.
And we appreciate your support.
And occasionally, you give us some feedback. Thank you very much. It's nice to know somebody's out there.
Yes, it is that time of year. We have a special guest with us today. Yes, it's that jolly old soul with the long gray beard and the twinkle in his eye. It's Jim Peace. Jim Peace, yes, it is. Welcome to our studio, Jim.
Well, thank you. It's really happy to see that there are actually two people here. I thought Lana Donna was, you know, was one person.
Yes, Donna Lana Ding Dong, right?
That's right.
We couldn't do it without each other, I tell you. James Peace, Emeritus Associate Professor, Natural Resource Ecology and Management, ISU. And he has been a part of this community for a long time. You have heard his voice on public radio enlightening us about all sorts of things wild and animal-like and what the heck to do with about the squirrels in our attic, all that sort of thing.
You bet.
Yeah. So are you officially retired?
Oh, I've been retired now for, oh my golly, since 2008. So I've been retired for 9+ years, and I'm enjoying it very, very much.
Very good, very good. You deal with all things environmental.
I have to just say one thing. He really does look like Santa Claus. He's got a right eyebrow that raises up into an arch where you see those pictures of Santa giving that quizzical look.
Right.
Okay, Jim, way to go.
And with my glasses, my cheaters on.
Yes, down the nose. You just need a little more white, but I'm sure that will come,
right? It's coming, yeah.
Oh,
it's
coming. Good.
Well, I asked Jim to join us today because he really is the go-to guy for the part of the world that we often ignore, all the creatures out there. And I'm going to ask him today about reindeer. So, Jim, what is this about reindeer? There's the American version. There's the European version. What is it about? There's Rudolph.
Oh,
yeah, I was going to say, do you want to know about Dasher or Dancer or Donner or Blitzen?
Yeah, about Rudolph. How did he get his red nose? Too much schnapps
Rotgut whiskey is.
So this is where you can tune in and learn the down and dirty here. So, Jim, what about reindeer?
Well, reindeer are really the European version of what we call caribou in North America. Ranger fur tarandus is a genus and species.
Ranger fur tarandus, right.
And that's the genus and species. And like a lot of species, it's really a circumpolar species. It's one that surrounds not just in North America, but across Europe and Asia as well. And there
the
are
North
other
Pole.
Things.
Yeah.
They're around the North Pole. And when that was connected by ice, especially with the last ice age, 12, 14, 15,000 years ago, round in there, those species became they were one species, and they still are one species. But as the ice receded,
they got a little isolated genetic pockets.
Exactly. Uh-huh, they got a little more isolated. And so you have some
diversity.
Yeah, diversity going on.
Oh,
exactly.
Boy, oh boy.
And adapting
to
particular
conditions.
And some
have red noses, and some have,
Right. That's right. That's maybe where the red noses. I think those are Russian. No, I'm not sure. So it has something to do with vodka. I don't know. So there are other species that are circumpolar that you might not think about too much. One is the snowy owls. Snowy owls are circumpolar. They're the same species around the pole. Weasels, the little ermine.
The white ones
in the winter. Yep, those are circumpolar. Snowshoe hares and Arctic hares are both
all the fairy tale animals.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
Yeah. And in fact, the reason they're fairy tale animals is that the winters are long in the north.
And
you've got lots
stories.
Of time to do. That's right. Oh. Lots of times to come up with stories about the critters outside your window. And that's probably, in fact, where some of the other myths and stories came from regarding reindeer, et cetera, et cetera. Winters are long. We're coming up, of course, when is that? Tomorrow? Next day.
Solstice Thursday.
Solstice,
the longest night of the year.
Right. Longest night.
Yes,
and,
the longest night.
Right, longest night,
and
shortest
it's,
day.
It's my favorite holiday because
because
that's when it changes. Then it starts to get longer after that.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I have a friend in Alaska who lives in Fairbanks, and I said, how do you take the long winter nights? And he said to me, well, after the 21st, it's getting lighter every day.
That's right.
Okay, he's an optimist.
I love to do this thing. On solstice evening, I do not use any electrical lighting. I put everything with kerosene lamps and candles just to remind myself and my family that this is a pivotal moment in the solar cycle.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
So I have a reindeer question.
Yeah.
Are they, in my mind anyway, are they bigger than the deer that we have? Are they just a big shaggy deer? How much bigger are they?
It depends on the subspecies because they range in size. So what we know in North America, across Canada, there's a boreal forest species of caribou that we call woodland caribou. Used to be, the range used to be half of Canada, 50% of Canada. Was its range. Now it's much, much reduced and is not doing really very well.
Yes,
woodland
they
caribou,
have some nasty exploits going on up there.
Right.
Extractive technology.
Yeah, it's probably been impacted a lot by oil and gas exploration, no question. But they inhabit forests, wet forests of the boreal forests that have lots of lichens in them and everything, because this is a species worldwide that is a very heavy eater of lichens.
Oh.
Lichens are those plants that come in lots of forms.
Is that fungal family or not?
No.
That's
right. It's actually two different plants, a fungus and an algae that you might say have taken a lichen to each other. Sorry. Yeah, I don't get openings like that very often.
No, that's really perfect.
So
they're getting an algae and a fungus.
And a fungus.
They must
have
great gut biota.
Right, they do. And they you're not talking about the algae and the fungus. You're talking about the caribou, the reindeer.
The algae and the fungus. Like, we should be all eating algae and fungus of certain sorts.
They do have the right biota in their stomachs, in their rumens, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
In order to digest those, can be fairly tough things to digest.
Diet of tree bark for six months
of
the year.
Yeah, like lots of other of the deer family, the cervid family, all the caribou are ruminants. That means they have a rumen, a gut like cattle do.
Do they have just one stomach or?
No, they have four.
Oh, just like cows.
And one of those is a rumen, which is really the important chamber, because that's the one that's filled with the right bacteria that can break down those plants.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't have the right bacteria, or they're eating the plants that don't match the bacteria, they'll starve to death with a full stomach.
Whoa.
It's a tough one. So, yeah, so you got to have the right gut biota there, you know, in order to digest these things. And that's true of our deer as well, that eat lots of woody stuff through the winter. If they don't have the wood digesting bacteria, and you feed them lots of hay, you can feed them very, very fine hay, and they can't digest it. So it and that happens occasionally.
Don't feed the deer.
Right. That's right. So we're dealing across the whole world, the northern hemisphere. We're dealing with about 7 subspecies of caribou or reindeer. So in Eurasia, in Europe and Asia, they're called reindeer. And in the northern U.S., they're called caribou. Northern U.S. In northern North America, they're called caribou. It's really the same species, but there are subspecies. We go back to the story when the ice separated them. Mm-hmm. They've had a few thousand years now, at least, to sort of develop some different genetics. So there are differences in size. There are differences in behavior. There are some genetic differences that are detected.
And these are based on that their environments have become slightly differentiated.
Right, right. Uh-huh. And there are sort of 3 ways that you can classify caribou. One is, are they barren ground versus more woodland? You know, so
what do the barren ground ones eat?
Well, they eat lichens, but they have to.
The lichens that grow on the rocks
exactly,
and stuff like that?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. They have to scratch down through. In fact, the name caribou probably comes from a Gwich'in or some other native people's language, which means pawer or scratcher to describe their behavior as they paw down through the snow to get to the lichens.
So all winter, that's all they eat?
That's
they
exactly
dig in
right.
through the snow and they eat these little lichen off the...
Eat off the rocks and off the... some lichens, there are different lots of different species of lichens, and some lichens stick up maybe... Oh, they're really tall, maybe 3 or 4 inches tall. You know? So they eat some of those.
Do they get pretty skinny in the winter?
Well, they certainly lose weight if they don't have enough food, and they have to fight off the cold as well. And this is one of the neat things about all the deer species, but especially caribou. They have special hairs. Their hairs are actually hollow. And so,
like possum hairs.
Exactly. even more so. And they're like little tubes of air. And it's the dead air space then that provides the wonderful insulation. Just like when we put on a big down jacket.
Right.
If it's flat, it doesn't give us much insulation, but if it's puffed up, it gives us lots of dead air space and better insulation. So that's what they have.
And do they also, since they're herding, do they like group together for warmth?
Okay. It's not so much for warmth.
Protection.
Exactly. Well, there are more eyes looking out.
What are their predators?
Oh, Arctic wolves.
Ooh.
And polar bears.
Ooh.
Just about anything that's big enough to take down a caribou. And those are the 2 main ones in the Arctic, of course, would be those 2 species. Grizzly bears, polar bears, and
so it's kind of like buffalo behavior.
Well,
in a lot of ways.
Yes and no. Another way to classify them is not just whether they're barren ground or woodland, but is based on their behavior. And the barren ground ones the ones in North America, do tend to be pretty gregarious. You know, they gather together in
these
huge
herds. Well, they don't
have
anywhere to hide from each other.
Well, no, you can't hide very much in the
you don't
in
get
the
Arctic. Lost in the forest.
Get behind a hill.
Yeah, right.
Which one? So the woodland caribou, for example, is a pretty solitary critter. They don't get in large herds at all. So it's the same species, totally different behavior because it's been separate for a while. The barren ground caribou, of course, the porcupine herd you've probably seen on Nature and other channels on TV, these incredible migrations. And they're one of the longest mammal migrations in the world.
Where do they go? From the north to the north?
They make a huge sort of triangular circuit. They end up on the calving grounds in the area that we now know as a wildlife refuge, which in the tax bill, which hopefully will not be passed, but probably will be passed yet this week. They're opening up to more oil and gas exploration.
Is Alaska we're talking about.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And on the North Slope. And so they end up on the plains at just the right time for calving, because those plains.
This would be the spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, spring up there. It would be summer down here, but spring up there. And because that's when the richest availability of sedges and other grasses and grass-like plants come up. And that's what the young need, the mothers need, in order to provide the richest milk for their young.
So
but then the mosquitoes come out.
No, but they have fur. So do they, this big migration that they make, they obviously don't respect the border between Alaska and Canada, right?
Not
at
all.
They just do a whole North American
loop. Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Politics don't bother them at all. So
the wisdom of the caribou.
That's right. Absolutely. So then the mosquitoes come out and they begin to move. They keep moving because the mosquitoes get to be too much.
What do they bite their noses or something?
Noses and eyes and every ears, any exposed skin at all. It's a tough one. So so they make this huge route. Woodland caribou do not. The reindeer in Eurasia tend not to be, well, they do form, and again, there are seven subspecies of this critter, the reindeer fur, the reindeer.
And we tend to forget that Europe and Asia are actually one landmass,
exactly.
So that gives them another borderless area.
Right. And also the peoples of Europe and Asia reacted differently to the large herds of caribou than the peoples of northern North America.
They didn't all just eat them?
Well, they all ate them.
Okay.
But the ones in Europe, we think at least 2,000 years ago, the peoples of Eurasia, of Europe and Asia, actually domesticated some of those.
Oh.
So that's where we get
the Laplanders?
The Laplanders and other peoples. Actually, there are different different peoples that have domesticated the herds, and they've domesticated them to different degrees, but they all depended on them for food, for shelter, for an awful lot of other things in their
shelter
culture.
Shelter in terms of, like, skins, right?
Skins, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Really, really important. So,
okay, so those igloos were not really built out of ice, right?
The igloos in North America certainly were built out of snow and ice, but not in Eurasia. The skins provided a lot of the still provide a lot of the shelter for them, as well as clothing in many cases. So they reacted differently. And in fact, it's been interesting. They domesticated reindeer were tried to be introduced into Alaska and some of the northern provinces.
You mean they actually took the genetic species from Eurasia and brought them over?
Right. Right.
Isn't that
because
like squirrels? Wasn't there a turf war over that?
Yeah. and in fact, it turned out it wasn't so much a turf war between the animals as between the humans, because they really found they didn't like it to domesticate them very much. They really wanted their traditional way of hunting them during the migration. So they've done
that. Well, they'd honed that for several thousand years.
Absolutely.
Why mess with it?
Why change? Exactly. So, but somebody thought they had a good idea, and it just hasn't worked out very well.
We were making some cultural impositions,
right,
I suppose.
Right, yeah. So, well, one of the things that is the other way that they so there are three ways of classifying them, whether they herd or whether they're solitary, whether they are barren ground versus a more woodland environment. So it's the sort of the ecotype they are. And then whether they are migrating or tend to stay in one place.
Oh, some don't migrate.
That's right. Woodland caribou don't migrate.
Oh, because their food source is so constant.
Exactly. Well, it's more constant than exactly.
Okay.
So you migrate. You undertake these long migrations.
Primarily would you move except for food? To get for your
right.
food?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. So, so it's those are some of the ways. But one of the things they all have in common is that they all have these massive antlers, you know.
Oh, the picturesque stuff. Oh, there
absolutely.
You go.
Male and female.
Male and female. Exactly. Exactly. Very good. Very good. Because it's one of the few deer species that both males and females have antlers, although the male antlers tend to be a little bit larger because they're more for defense. But the females have them as well. It's also a good defense for them against predators like wolves.
Right. I'm trying to think what would be the adaptive advantage.
Right.
Oh.
And
okay.
That and the fact that they have this sort of scoop shovel on the front that sticks out
straight. Oh, for digging in this.
Exactly.
No. Oh.
Exactly.
How
and
clever.
They sweep their heads back and forth, and that scoop shovel piece of antlers in front moves the snow
out of the way.
Oh, I'd
rather have one of those than a snowblower any day.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's kind of hard to get through doorways, though. Yeah, we'd have to make doors a lot taller.
We can accommodate. I mean, just for the thrill of it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. And
like
cars would all be convertibles, and, you know, you'd have to have your antlers sticking out.
We can adapt.
Absolutely.
I'd like to remind everybody, we are listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio. For the heart of Iowa, we're talking reindeer here. And what you're hearing right now is some reindeer calls. It's from a
two. No, it's not the reindeer calling. It's
no, no,
the
no. It's a guy
the
calling.
Reindeer,
this
right?
is music from the Sami people, Samijok people up in Lapland, who like Jim says they have learned to live with these folks. This is by the musician John Berquist. Here's a little recording to go with that. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are around the kitchen table with Jim Peace. He knows a lot about reindeer and other wintry sort of animals. So what else you got to tell us about reindeer,
well,
Jim?
Well, I was just dancing around the room here, around
yes,
the kitchen
was.
To that music, which sounded like a schottish to me.
Yeah, there you go.
One, two, three, yeah. Hop, one,
what,
two, three,
would you
hop,
say he was Finnish?
Well, yeah, the musician, John Berquist, he was a... He lived in Ames for a while, and he's a historian, a Scandinavian guy, and he could, you know, he could sing and play accordions and all sorts of useful stuff, you know? Yeah.
Hey, do reindeer actually do they moo? Do they call? What do they do?
They have grunts.
Grunts.
Grunts, yeah, and I'm not good at grunts, so.
Oh.
Reindeer grunts.
Calling them would be difficult.
Uh-huh. So. But I suppose if they're domesticated, yeah. There's Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, all those nice folks.
Right.
We romanticize the heck out of them this time of year. In the Night Before Christmas poem, they're referred to as the eight tiny reindeer. And I never thought of reindeer as overly tiny. But the ones that I did see pictures of, as you said, that attempted relocation of reindeer
right.
into into Alaska and Canada, and they were quite a bit smaller. Short little guys.
Well, they're again, it's one of the subspecies. They range from a large German Shepherd of size, maybe a little bigger than that, up to quite large. The woodland caribou, as I said, is the largest of the subspecies.
Wait, some of them are little like a dog?
Mm-hmm. They are.
Those are the herded ones?
Yes. Yeah. Some of the herded ones. Uh-huh. Now, there are different subspecies in the herding communities as well. And there are, I think, perhaps one of the seven used to be on Queen Charlotte Islands or something like that. It was considered a totally separate subspecies, and it's now extinct. I think
that's
one of the
seven. That's what they get for being
sevens.
A separate subspecies.
Right. Well, or being on an island, which is essentially what we've
very
done.
Very small
course.
Genetic pool. Yeah.
Right. Small genetic pool and high exploitation by humans. And that's sort of a recipe for extinction right there. it can be difficult to survive on an island.
How are the numbers of reindeer on the planet doing?
Well, they're considered. It depends on the subspecies. Mm-hmm. Certainly, woodland caribou are in a great deal of trouble, and they're certainly threatened, if not endangered. They demand some special attention by us. Barren ground caribou to date seem to be, while the populations fluctuate quite a bit.
That means us North Americans have sort of screwed it up, right?
Right. Well, certainly for the woodland caribou, that's especially true. Although we're not completely sure just what's causing the population decline. Is it habitat?
Or habitat.
Or is it other things that we've done? For example, climate change. And this is one of the among the many circumpolar species, climate change is probably one of the biggest threats to most
habitat.
Of them. So, yeah, exactly. Their habitat changes, or they're not able to adapt quickly enough. Perhaps their food changes, the winter food, the ability of polar bears, we've heard a lot about the lack
of enough ice
during the summer months. They have to swim longer distances or they drown. Lots of changes that are unintended, but certainly the Arctic is the part of the Earth that has had the largest to date single impact, both poles actually, of climate change.
Well, in your many years of research, I assume you go once in a while, and have you visually, personally seen that sort of thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I see it. You know, the middle latitudes, the temperate region in which we live, has the slowest change. It's harder to see. And it's, of course, where the denial is centered.
That's where most people live.
But if you go to the tropics anywhere around the world, if you go to the poles anywhere around the world, it is so incredibly obvious.
Just visually, seasonally, everything.
Absolutely. You see the changes. The people know the changes are there. We ought to know it, but there seem to be some among us, particularly among the political crowd, politicians that seem to find it in their
vested interest.
Interest to deny it. So, but it's very clearly impacting species already in the polar regions, and caribou are likely to be impacted. One of the things that happens, a part of population fluctuation, going up and down, is the farther you get away from the equator, the more population fluctuations are a part of the natural order of things. We know, for example, the fluctuation in lemmings and voles, the little mouse-like critters.
Lemmings, oh boy.
Yes. Yeah, we can get into a whole series of lemming jokes, but we won't. We could die trying, in fact.
Well, but now reindeer are vegetarians, right?
Correct. But the lemmings and voles go through every 3 to 4 years. They go through these population peaks and declines.
The wolves and the coyotes.
The things that depend on them, the foxes, and especially the snowy owls.
Oh, the owls.
Depend on them, and they go up and down. And so every 3 to 4 years, we see snowy owls that come farther south in search of food because the lemmings are at a low in their cycle. So that's common. That's been going on probably for millennia.
Isn't it kind of a form of species birth control?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. It certainly is. And the species that depend on them either have to migrate, die. So you adapt. You eat something else. If there is something else, you move, you migrate like the snowy owls do, or you die. Those are the three choices: move, adapt, or die. And in the case of snowy owls, they can move. In the case of Arctic foxes, for example, their populations have gone up and down. We know this from fur records for hundreds of years.
What color are Arctic foxes?
They're white in the winter when you trap them. Yeah.
And what are they in the summer?
They tend to be whitish to more fox-like colors, brown to red.
Oh.
There's a lot of variation, again, around the circumpolar mm-hmm. goal. And other species that vary as you go into the boreal forest, the snowshoe hare varies, and their populations go up and down every 10 to 12 years. My master's mm-hmm. research was up in northern Alberta, where we studied snowshoe hares. I was a part of a long-term research project on them. And you would go from seeing 10 hares an acre at the peak. There's bunnies everywhere.
How big are they?
Oh, they're the size of a cottontail, you know.
Oh,
Their ears are shorter. Their back feet are much larger. And they turn white in the wintertime.
And are they food for people?
They are food.
Yeah.
For people, but mostly for things like
wolves.
Lynx.
Lynx.
And great horned owls. Uh-huh. And their populations go up and down with the snowshoe hares. So you go from 10 hares an acre 1 year to a year later in a particular location, one hare per 10 acres. Two orders of magnitude reduction. It's huge. It's just amazing to see that change. And I was able to witness that firsthand. And it's pretty remarkable.
Wow.
So, and what we were studying is why that population happens. Well, one of the things that we know from studying populations all around the world is that one of the things that causes these extreme fluctuations in the poles, especially boreal forest on north, the closer you get, is that the food webs are very, very – they're simpler and simpler. There are fewer and fewer species to – if you're going to adapt, you're going to change to something else, there's not much to change to. So the population goes down or goes up, you know. So you
– Does that mean there's only so many lichen?
Well, not so much in caribou, but that can vary. The caribou populations vary with their ability to maybe get to the right food at the right time.
Well, what do snowshoe hares eat?
Snowshoe hares eat woody vegetation in the wintertime, and they don't dig down mm-hmm. to get to their food. So if you have 5 feet of snow, there's not much sticking up for them to eat.
So are they like the rabbits here? They will ring the trees and
– Absolutely. Yeah. But when they're ringing – that behavior that we even see here in central Iowa in very tough winters, we'll see them – taking a tree the size of your wrist.
Yeah.
And what they're getting, that's starvation behavior. That's saying, boy, if you're eating basically anything above the size of your index finger mm-hmm. is starvation food.
Okay.
You're
so
filling your belly.
If we have a lot of snow here this year and the rabbits start doing that,
right.
What should we put out for
Nothing.
Them? Oh, just let them ruin the landscape. Okay.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Or you can put out fences to keep them from ruining your landscape,
right.
But don't feed them.
Don't feed them.
Why?
Oh, because they're
exactly. They won't have the right. In the case of rabbits, they have what's called a cecum mm-hmm. rather than a rumen. It's a little bag. It's a sort of a. It's not really a stomach. They have a simple system like we do, but at the end they have this little cecum, which is filled with bacteria, which are able to digest the woody vegetation and turn it into things that they can then absorb. We won't go any farther with that at this point, unless you want to. But it's different than a rumen, but it's the same function. And if you don't have the right bacteria and you change foods, you can starve to death with a full stomach. And that's what happens sometimes.
Yeah, so we think we're doing the right thing by feeding stuff.
Exactly.
And maybe we don't know as much as we
think.
And maybe
we have too many rabbits anyway.
Right. That's right. That's right.
So what's some advice for feeding birds this time of year?
Oh, for feeding birds. So we've moved from reindeer. Okay.
Well, we'll jump all over here.
Okay, that's right.
Just we're into feeding.
For feeding birds, if you have one feeder and you can only feed one thing, feed black oil sunflower seeds. Not the sunflower seeds that you buy in the store for human consumption, but the black oil. They're smaller. You'll get the largest variety of birds. They have lots of oil and fat in them, so that's what birds need in order to make it through the night.
What about the soot balls?
Soot balls are fine. Okay. The suet balls, you can certainly feed that, but you get greater variety because you get a lot of the seed eaters that won't take that suet very much. So if you can only feed one thing, feed black oil sunflower seed. If you've got options, if you have places to put up like we do, we have feeders all around our house. So every window, there are bird feeders outside. So we have a total of about 18 to 20 feeders up in the wintertime.
You are busy. You are busy, Dave.
Well, I should say that my wife, Cindy, is busy.
Oh,
she's
Cindy's
the one
busy.
Who
she
really feeds them. Yeah. I buy the seed and she feeds them. And she tends to like things like the little finch feed, which has Niger seed in it, thistle seed, and has broken up hearts of sunflower. And that's especially good for the small birds like all of the goldfinches and the pine siskins that we have around a lot now. And the house finches and the juncos and all those and the chickadees.
If you've been watching birds wintering here in Ames for many years.
Yeah.
Have you seen much fluctuation of what we have here?
Oh, absolutely.
So what's happening?
It depends on the weather to the far north, natural patterns of variation, or at least patterns, whether they're natural or not, is up for grabs. Patterns of variation in their winter food in the north. So a lot of the species that come down here, for example, this year, we don't have as many juncos. That's a boreal forest nesting bird across the boreal forest of Canada, northern U.S. and Canada. And we had some early, and we only have like three or four now, which is very unusual for us. We usually have 30 to 40 juncos.
Does that mean they're not coming down?
Maybe
they
went further south. Maybe they're at other people's feeders. We don't know for sure. We need to look at the Christmas bird counts that were just conducted in the Ames area this past weekend. We'll look at those, and you look at trends, and you can see trends. For example, there's a little boreal forest bird called the red-breasted nuthatch, which we had for probably 10 years in a row. We haven't had them now for 3 years. Why? I don't know. Maybe there's plenty of food for them up north and milder winters. They don't need to come as far south.
Oh.
Who knows? Lots of reasons that
things are moving around. Oh, I have something from the Donalana Kitchen News Desk.
Oh,
tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick. That's the ticker tape. News Desk, I got a message from my friend Merle Hall in Granger, Iowa, and he said he has a sighting. Snowy owls were seen near his house. Snowy owls.
Yeah.
Talk about coming from. And if you want to see them, he's seeing them a free time. They're sitting on the exit signs near the Highway 30 and Highway 17 off-ramp. So they're snowy owls.
How big is the snowy owl? What's it look like?
Well, the snowy owl is a white owl, just as its name implies. Mm. There's a difference between males and females. The females tend to have more brown speckling on them, and the adult males are almost totally snowy white with very little brown flecking.
Stunning.
The young males tend to have smaller bits of flecking on them. And this is one of those, what we call an invasion year, or a year in which they've come south out of the Arctic. Now you think, well, why are they doing that? Remember, we talked about earlier about the lemmings. Well, they are a bird that nests on the ground in the Arctic. because there are no trees. The only trees up there are about 6 inches high, so it wouldn't do them any good to climb a tree or to fly up to a tree. It's on the ground. So they nest on the ground, usually on little rises. And again, if you've seen nature or any of those other...
Well, how big are they?
Snowy owls are about the size of our barred owl. They're a little under 2 feet in length. Okay?
So they're big enough to be eating rabbits.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but they really depend on lemmings and voles.
What's a lemming look
it's
like?
It's a little mouse-like critter, basically. They all look like mice. And some people would say they all look alike, but to the discerning eye, lemmings are very different than voles.
Do we have lemmings
mice.
Here?
We don't have lemmings here. They're a northern species, right?
Okay.
We do have the voles, though, that we have, the little short-tailed vole looks similar to lemmings. So short ears.
We have mice.
We do have
plenty
of
mice.
We have lots of species of mice, though, too.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I have my own
snowy
owls
are one of the few species that are able to adapt very quickly to increases in food supply. So if the lemming population suddenly goes up early in the spring before the snowy owls begin to lay their eggs, they have a larger clutch of eggs. They might have 8, 9, 10, 12 young ones. So there are lots and lots of snowy owls. So they've responded very quickly. Many species can respond to their food supply.
And
the
egg must be quite large then.
Well, they're fairly good size. Yeah, they're like a pullet egg, I would say.
Oh, that's not so bad.
A little bigger, maybe.
And do they travel in flocks, or how do they come down here?
Well, here's what happens. So the lemming population during the summer, they raise all these young. But they're feeding all these young as well, and the lemming population drops for whatever reason, probably due to predation, very heavy predation. And all of a sudden, there aren't enough lemmings around to feed them through the winter, and they're having trouble. So they go to where they have the option to move, so they come farther south. And the farther south they come tells you how hungry they are.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, and it was, I think, 3 years ago, 2013, maybe 2014, we had a huge influx of snowy owls, the largest in recorded human history. And they went as far south as Oklahoma. Snowy owls in the Oklahoma is very weird. But we commonly have them in Iowa, usually across the northern part of the state. But this year, there are over, I haven't counted them up since the weekend. Last weekend was a heavy weekend for Christmas bird counts. So we might have some new additions to it. But they're probably in the range of 75 to 100 sightings in Iowa. The one that was sighted out at west of town
west
here
of town,
was
yeah.
A new sighting.
Yeah,
now, it means, are they a new owl? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
So we've had that many sightings in different locations. Sometimes what happens, they'll hang around an area long enough to see it, to eat several times, and they will hang around as long as the eating's good. So if there are lots of mice around, we don't have much snow cover, they're doing really well. On the other hand, if we have too many people not following good snowy owl etiquette.
Which
means stay in your car, don't get out, it's a good blind, don't get too close, don't feed them, among other things. You want to make sure that you keep your distance. If the owl tends to be watching you so much, you're probably too close.
Mm.
Back off. And, you know, we've had that. In fact, that one west of town, there were people who didn't understand what they were doing or didn't care, and they scared it off. So it's now probably still in the area, but maybe not. And when you scare an owl off, particularly, even though snowy owls can be diurnal, which means daytime dwelling, they hunt because the Arctic summer is 24 hours. They
light
have to be able to hunt in the daylight as well as the Arctic winters, which are all night. So they're both diurnal and nocturnal. They can hunt in the daytime, and They're often then can be scared up, and Iowa has so many roads and so many cars, they can get hit by cars if you scare them up. So you want to kind of keep your distance and let them do their thing. If they're watching the ground, you're probably fine. If they're watching you, you're probably too
close. And are they in groups, or you're just going to see one?
See one, usually.
See one at a time. That one probably will not be at the Highway 30, Highway 17 exit.
Probably not.
But it does our heart good to know that, yes, it is there. This is KHOI Community Radio. Thanks for your support of this station. You can find out more at khoifm.org. I'd like to take a little break here for a little Christmas story and some Christmas music. There is a band that I really love named Bohola. They're a Irish band from Chicago, but they've put their music with some stories, some Christmas stories. The author here is Patrick Cavanaugh, and here we go. It's about Christmas in small-town Britain.
One Christmas was so much like another. In those years around the sea town corner, now and out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices, I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases roll down toward the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into the wool-white bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the fireman. It was on the afternoon of the Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden waiting for cats with her son Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, is white as Lapland, though there were no reindeers, but there were cats. Patient, cold and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slink and sidle over the white-backed garden walls, and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay, off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Prothero's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. Or if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder.
Fire!
Cried Mrs. Prothero, and she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms toward the house, and smoke indeed was pouring out of the dining room, and the gong was bombulating, and Mrs. Prothero was announcing ruin like a town crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats and whales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house, laden with snowballs, and stopped at the open door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Prothero, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying,
"A fine Christmas!"
and smacking at the smoke with a slipper.
"Call the fire brigade!"
cried Mrs. Prothero as she beat the gong.
"They won't be there!"
said Mr. Prothero.
"It's Christmas!"
There was no fire to be seen, only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Prothero standing in the middle of them, waving his slipper as though he were conducting.
"Do something!"
he said, and we threw all our snowballs into the smoke. I think we missed Mr. Prothero and ran out of the house to the telephone box.
"Let's call the police as well,"
Jim said.
"And the ambulance. And Ernie Jenkins. He likes fires."
Well, we only called the fire brigade, and soon the fire engine came, and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Prothero got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. And when the firemen turned off the hose and were standing in the wet, smoky room, Jim's aunt, Mrs. Prothero, came downstairs and peered in at them. Jim and I waited very quietly to hear what she would say to them. She said the right thing always. She looked at the three tall firemen in the shining helmets, standing among the smoke and cinders and dissolving snowballs, and she said,
"Would you like anything to read?"
A little bit of Christmas from Wales. That was from a CD called Bohola, Childhood Christmas. We're talking all kinds of things about Christmas, and Jim Pease is with us. I have another reindeer question. Now, is this fact or fantasy? Can a reindeer or a bunch of them actually pull a sleigh? Is that part of the domestication?
It certainly is. In fact, they across Eurasia, they
but they don't fly.
Well, you know, it all depends on how you believe.
I
wouldn't say that it's beyond the realm of possibility.
So they could. They can be hitched to a sleigh.
They do hitch them to sleds and sleighs and pull them. I don't know if there's an 8 reindeer hitch or not, other than Santa's, but
they could be made.
Or in the case of Rudolph, a 9 reindeer hitch.
More research needs to be done.
Absolutely. And the flying subspecies may be an 8th one as well, other than the 7 that we know about. So, yeah, it's the whole Christmas season has been really interesting to me because thousands and thousands of years, the winter solstice has been noticed by humans and celebrated, as you say, by
At least we have not managed to change the rhythms in the sky.
No, that's exactly right. Not yet, anyway. We haven't changed
the
rhythm.
Oh, dear. I hope I don't live to see that.
Right. Yeah, I hope not either. But so those sort of festivals of light and diminishing light and coming – the change in light have been noticed by human beings.
And animals
for forever probably.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that we have turned this – our religious institutions, or those cultural institutions, sort of absconded with that solstice celebration.
The primary early
and
material.
Let's make this a religious celebration. So smart religions have wrapped in the traditional celebrations of people for a long, long time. And Christmas season is one of those. And then those, of course, continue to change. So
yeah.
the whole idea of the reindeer and Santa Claus has gone through lots of iterations. And I think the original poem that was written in the 1820s was the first one that I know about anyway to come up with
the night before Christmas.
But that was in the 1820s,
mm-hmm,
and it probably came from Europe. Then the names of the reindeer have even changed a little bit. And then it wasn't until the 1930s that Rudolph was added.
Oh, yes.
As well.
That's a Disney-esque sort of thing.
Yeah.
Gene Autry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it added to the ongoing celebration. And funny
about wrapping things into our conscious, somehow The business people got a hold of this,
that
there was cash involved and then like transitions and mute and presents. That's all part of it. I've asked past guests this quickly, Jim. What does Christmas taste like for you?
Oh, for me, it's a dish that I grew up with that it was part of every Christmas I can remember. And
it comes from your grandmother
It does come from my grandmother. It was called cranberry ice.
Ooh.
It's cranberries, lots of sugar, of course, some orange juice, orange rind. You freeze it, and you have this wonderful sherbet with your meal, be it carnivore or herbivore.
It's a palate cleanser during the main course.
It is during the main course, right?
Well,
there you go.
You
take it with it. It's a great, wonderful, wonderful Christmas for me.
And how do they freeze it then?
What is it?
In the freezer.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
There you go. Right. So thanks to our special guest, Jim Pease. Thanks for talking about reindeer.
My pleasure.
And bowls.
You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Today we talked about all kinds of good things. We've had music by the band Bohola. And also a little bit of the Philharmonic, the Philadelphia Philharmonic. We'll go out with some music from the top of the world. A thing from a band called Northern Lights, called Hildrig. Happy Christmas to us all. My name is Lana Noctigal.
Merry, Merry Christmas.
My name is Lana Noctigal.
Donna Priskintas.
We had great engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food. Enjoy life.